So let's start with a story that Matthew tells. Matthew tells this story in his Gospel, chapter 14, about how one night the disciples go out fishing. And in the middle watches of the night, Jesus decides to join them, but he doesn't have a boat, so he walks out onto the Sea of Galilee. And in the middle of the night, they see Jesus walking on water, and it completely freaks them out. And Matthew says, they thought they saw a ghost. In the stress of that moment, in the fear of that moment, in the pressure of that moment, the Jesus they knew became distorted, and they were looking at what they thought was a ghost, and Jesus has to reassure them. And that story becomes symbolic for disciples in every generation who, in the stress and the pressure and the fears of life, in the shaping that life places upon us, we can so easily distort the Jesus who is to the Jesus we think we see. And in this sermon series over these last few weeks, we called it Jesus the Deleted Scenes, so that we could think about those aspects of Jesus' life which, under pressure from our society, we are actually distorting the Jesus the Bible reveals. And this morning, on Father's Day, we're going to look at what Jesus said about family, but actually how it's more than just family. It's about everything that we've been talking about and celebrating this morning, that this Jesus is to be trusted with my soul, my life, and my... Very good. Okay, so why don't we read this together? Everybody with me? I can hardly wait to hear myself speak with this amount of enthusiasm. Right, okay. So, here we are from Luke 14, the cost of being a disciple. Let's read it together. Large crowds were traveling with Jesus, and turning to them, he said, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not carry their cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Won't you first sit down and estimate the cost to see if you have enough money to complete it? For if you lay the foundation and are not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule you, saying, 'This person began to build and wasn't able to finish.' Or suppose a king is about to go to war against another king. Won't he first sit down and consider whether he's able with 10,000 men to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000? If he's not able, he'll send a delegation while the other is still a long way off and will ask for terms of peace. In the same way, those of you who do not give up everything you have cannot be my disciples." I was at the tip yesterday. Always cathartic. And as I walked past with my little pile of wood and hardcore, there was this guy swearing and blinding and huffing and puffing. And I looked, and his lovely car was trashed. I did really enjoy it, I have to admit. So he's got this really lovely car, but he seems to be getting out loads and loads of carpets and soil. And I was thinking, carpets and soil, what's that all about? And I couldn't resist that. I said, "You're right, mate." And he said, well, I can't tell you exactly what he said in church, but he said, "Blinking allotment, it's the worst return on investment I have ever made." we got this allotment, and now he said, look, I used all this carpet to keep down the weeds, and they've all, and he said, it's trash my car, I clean it up. And he just went on this big bender about how the allotment wasn't working for him. The worst return on investment that he'd ever had. Return on investment, somebody give me a definition. What's a return on investment? Who's done economics? Come on. Profit, okay? Not PHF. Interest. Okay, what's the principle of a return on investment? You get what you get. Yeah, you get back more than what you put in. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. Something, you know, speculate to accumulate. So this idea that if you're in business, you have to spend some money to make more money. And what you make is a return, is understood to be a return on your investment. Okay, so what else do you invest other than money? What else? Time? What else? Resources? Energy? Love? Skills? Faith? Was that faith or fear? I wasn't sure which one.
Faith.
Right, thank you. So a whole bunch of stuff. You see, that's why when England lose a rugby match in the last minute. Oh, be quiet, you horrible man. That's why athletes cry. It's not so much that they hate losing. It's the hours and hours and hours that they have invested in the training, the relationships and the pleasures that they've turned their back on, because they've made this huge investment in order to win, and then they fail. It's absolutely destroying. This whole idea of a return on investment is a helpful idea to think about the Christian faith. Some investments can be cheap, others are huge. I remember sitting at Spring Harvest putting £10 notes in separate envelopes as my friend Phil had borrowed £100,000 and he was going to give 10 quid notes to everybody at Spring Harvest on all three sites, and he was going to say the words, if you need it, keep it, but if you don't, here's a way you can invest that 10 quid to make money for AIDS orphans around the world. In the first year, they made £1 million profit. But he didn't have £100,000. He'd borrowed it against his house. And we remember praying and sticking the £10. Now that's an investment. That's risking stuff. And if you're in some businesses and industries like the oil industry, you have to invest absolutely tens of millions, hundreds of millions of pounds with the hope of finding oil, because the return on your investment is so great. Everybody with me so far? Okay. This is the principle that Jesus used. It's not a total metaphor for who he is and what he's done, but he used this metaphor when he told the parable of the pearl of great price. Jesus' whole understanding of the kingdom of God and the life he was offering people was to say, look, following me is expensive. Jesus is expensive. He will cost you absolutely everything. But your return on your investment is incredibly more than all you can ask or imagine. God is no man's debtor. That's what Jesus meant by the story of the pearl of great price. And it's this theme that we pick up on Father's Day as we look at the cost of following Jesus in regard to our families. Now, it's one thing to learn to accept rejection. It's another thing to reject acceptance. Just get your brains around that. It's one thing to learn to accept rejection. It's another thing to reject acceptance. And that's exactly what Jesus is doing here back in Luke 14. Luke tells us that Jesus was popular really popular, and large crowds were following him around on hanging on his every word. They loved him. He was so interesting. They loved his teaching. He was much better than all the other teachers. They loved his miracles. They were fascinating. And they loved the way he was rude to the religious leaders. He was great to be with. And because they were turning up to listen to him, they thought mistakenly that they were following him. They were to find out that just turning up to listen wasn't showing up to be a disciple of Jesus. Jesus had so much more than to be their favorite celebrity. It was so important that he was more than just temporarily popular. Jesus has to make it clear that it's one thing to turn up and listen, it's another thing to genuinely follow. He has to do that because he longs to set people free. He longs to forgive them. He longs to invite them to live in his kingdom. But he knows that that will only be experienced when they give their soul, their life, their all, when they give up their claims to life as they know it, and to trust him fully for the life that he knows. People don't become forgiven and free if they just treat Jesus as their favorite celebrity. So it was precisely because he'd become trendy and in that Jesus says some very hard things to the crowd to reject a cheap popularity that missed the point of what he was about. If anyone comes to me, he says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple. Now that is stark, isn't it? Oh, great. We did have a late night last night, didn't we? This is really stark. And one of the reasons it's stark is that it's at odds with so many other things and seems so inconsistent with so many other things Jesus said. For starters, Jesus was always teaching love and forgiveness. That's the total antithesis of hate, isn't it? And if you're supposed to hate your family, then Jesus was a hypocrite, because even when he was dying on a cross, he made provision for his mother in the most loving and compassionate and considerate way. Something else is going on here. And it's a technique of rabbis' teaching. What Jesus is doing here is he's overemphasizing a point to make it dramatically memorable. I remember several times people have given me advice in my life in an overly dramatic way to make the point. I remember it once at Bible college when I was invited to become the minister of a church where I would be the only minister there. And one of my lecturers said, "Andy, I don't care if the Archangel Gabriel appears in your room and says, go to wherever it was. He says, don't listen." It was a way of making his point. Similarly, when I was, before I came to Maybridge and I was at Stopsley, I'd been the youth minister, and the senior minister resigned. That had nothing to do with me. And people in the church wanted me to become the senior minister. And I took some advice from outside. And one of my mentors said, "Don't, whatever you do, do that. Don't become the minister. They've got to know you as a youth minister. You'll never be free of that. You'll need to go somewhere else." I said, "But what if God calls me?" And he looked me straight in the eye. He said, "Don't listen." And then we laughed, but it made the point. That's what Jesus is doing here. He's over-exaggerating the point so that it becomes memorable. So what is the point? The point to the crowds chasing the celebrity Jesus is, if you really want to follow me, then not even family, the people you love the most, compete for importance and devotion. It's a costly thing to follow me. And then Jesus onto how we see ourselves. And he comes out with this really fascinating line. Hate even their own lives. If they don't even hate their own lives. What's that doing here? Jesus said you have to love your love your neighbor as yourself. So if you hate yourself, you're going to have some pretty difficult neighborly relations. Again, he's saying, emphasizing, exaggerating to make a really important point that most people today don't get. When we are preoccupied with our families, it's really a preoccupation with ourselves. Love for family is love for self in disguise. Let me say that again. Love for our family so often is love for ourselves in disguise. It works like this. A boy sees a girl and thinks, wow, she would be great. And a girl sees a boy and thinks, wow, he would be great. Great for what? Well, great for me. What this relationship is going to do for me. And they go out, and because of what the other will bring to them, give to them, make them feel, it's all about what's in it for me. And then they get married because that's what they want to do. They'd like to be married. It's what's in it for me. And they pursue their careers because of what's in it for me. And at some point in that developing this story, they decide, I would like a child. We would like a child. It's what's in it for me. And so when the children come along, actually, you can use all the language in the world about providing for the family now, creating memories with the children. But actually, essentially, it's still a love for me, but it's in disguise. Our model of family is essentially individualistic. It's affected by society, but not really part of it. Family is our ego in disguise. It's still all about us. And bizarrely, the church can fall into the same trap, where the needs of the family are not so much met in church, but over-met in church, where Jesus becomes a means to an end of having a better family. And that's exactly what Jesus is trying to address here. He did not come to make our experience of family better. He came to demand that we leave all our idols behind and surrender everything to him completely, including an idol of family life. Families may be very respectable idols, but Jesus still calls them idols all the same. Following Jesus means dying to all that we hold dearest in our lives, and that includes our loved ones. True spirituality is not concerned with nurturing our ego, but it's about bringing it to its death. It's the total reverse. The essential starting point of the Christian life is self-abandonment and self-emptying. And that's what Jesus is on about here. And after a couple of practical examples, the last verse he says simply, in the same way, let's go to the next one. In the same way, those of you who do not give up everything you have cannot be my disciples. What Jesus was saying about family was just an illustration of that basic point. That this return on investment that Jesus wants us to make demands my soul, my life, my all, and that includes my family. Look, please hear me. Jesus is not cruel. He loves us perfectly. But he calls us to give as if it's the only way, because it's the only way we can be blessed, forgiven, rescued, and free. He's the pearl of great price. It's all or nothing. And it's this unique return on investment that Jesus offers. A couple of things to finish. Number one, this sermon does need qualifying. Jesus didn't qualify it here, but it does need qualifying. We can be distracted by family, but we can also be distracted from family. This is not license for neglect. Nobody loves family more than Jesus. He called his God Father. Marriage was his idea. Families are his creation. Marriage is a sacrament. Jesus is not encouraging neglect. He's saying he must come first over family. And that is not the same as putting church before family. Two other thoughts. Following Jesus is expensive, but it's either about paying the cost now or later. That's stark, isn't it? But it's true. And the last thing is this. At the heart of the Christian message, the God we worship does what he asks of us. At the heart of the Christian message, there is a God, the Father, who is prepared to abandon his son so that you and I can become family. At the heart of the Christian message is a son who is prepared to be abandoned by his father so that his death could bring forgiveness to us all. And at 3 p.m, Jesus cried out from the cross in a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lima sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus does not call us to do anything that he has not already done for us, to sacrifice his family for the sake of us all.